So Daniel chapter 11, we come into the last two chapters, really. We're going to look at Daniel chapter 11, trying to finish today this study. But this is an amazing chapter. And the reason why it's amazing is because it began in chapter 10. If you remember, the last three chapters really are going together. It's about a vision, prophecy that Daniel had been given. If you remember from last week's study, and I think the week before, we saw that Daniel received a vision. He received prophecy about the end times, about what would be happening with Israel, and it impacted him. It impacted him in a way that he was sick and he was exhausted, to the point that I believe verse 9 of chapter 10 says that he was basically fainting or passed out, and he couldn't stand any longer. And so this now will go into the explanation of what he saw. What was it that the Lord had given to him? And so the 11th chapter of Daniel is probably the most detailed prophecy in all of the scripture. And it's got amazing details of great empires, political developments, end time powers. And if you remember last week, and what I've already said, is that this deals with the impact that it will have upon God's people, the nation of Israel. So chapter 11 is about the prophecies of these great kingdoms and those that were rulers in it. And one of the best ways I think I could explain it to you is when I was in high school, I ran track, and there was an event called the relay. And I did the 440 relay. I did the mile relay, but the 440 relay was the one that I did more of. And in that, you have four different people running about 110 yards approximately each. And if you weren't the leadoff runner, you'd be looking back and you'd be waiting for the runner to come to you. You will have already marked off how many steps would be, that when they reach a mark, you turn around and you begin running. In a sense, we're going to get to a certain point in our study today, this morning, excuse me, which will be verse 21. Verses 1 through 20 is looking back and waiting for that runner to come. And when he hits that mark, we're going to turn and begin looking forward. And that's 21, kind of 21, really on into verse 35 and to the end of the chapter. So we're going to be talking about the kingdoms that we've already discussed in chapter 7 and 8, even chapter 2 of the book of Daniel, the different kingdoms, the rulers that were there. And then we're going to ease into Antiochus Epiphanes. That's going to be after verse 21. And then the final section of the book, we're going to get into the Antichrist. And we're going to see how all of these things kind of build up to and point to the Antichrist. So really a history lesson, verses 1 through 20, and then a little bit of history and certainly the future from 21 through verse 45. So as we look at this, we're going to see the vision coming down to Antiochus, verses 1 through 20. If you'll follow along, I'm going to read and just comment. A lot of it's going to be pretty quick and pretty straightforward. It's honestly more of a history lesson. And so I think we can pull away a few things, but it's knowledge that we need to understand. These things will tie into the book of Matthew, chapter 24, which will come after the book of Daniel. We may take a little detour into 1st, 2nd Thessalonians, and then we're going to jump into the book of Revelation. And these are all building down and putting that foundation for us as we go forward in our study on the end times. So verse 1 of chapter 11 says, "Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I, Daniel speaking, I stood up to confirm and to strengthen him." And so we see Daniel now speaking. He's risen. Remember, he couldn't even stand. He was exhausted. He was pretty much fainting and passing out in the last chapter. And it says that he was encouraged. After being encouraged, after being confirmed, it says that he was then strengthened or protected, that the word can be used as one who comes to a refuge or a fortress. So we have to understand the imagery is that Daniel's been in the spiritual battle. Chapter 9, he was given prophecy. A few years later, he was given chapter 10, this incredible prophecy of the end times, and he's burdened by it. And so he's coming into a place that would be like a refuge or a fortress, and he could let down his guard and he could rest a bit, but he's standing up, he feels strengthened, he feels encouraged, and so he's coming out of this this sense of being beat up in the midst of a battle. That's where we're coming into in verse 1. It's linking chapter 10 to chapter 11. Now, verse 2, we see the prophecy goes on to speak about Persia. It says, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." And so this is where Daniel's coming in. He says, "Listen, I want to tell you the truth." This is really good for us to understand, because this chapter and this book is really sought after to discredit and disprove by the skeptics. Because if it's true, then there is a true God, and he is the living God, and he is the God of prophecy. He's the God of end times. And when he says things are going to happen, they truly come to pass. According to some scholars, Daniel 11 has 135 prophecies contained in it. It's not that many verses for 135 prophecies. There are links and connections and overlay here, and it all deals with these prophecies. Now, remember, the first 20 verses is history pretty much for Daniel. Well, for Daniel, he's telling prophecy. For us, it's history. We've seen these things happen. So just take it within that scope. But these are all Daniel telling what's going to happen in the future. And there's only one who can deal in the realm of prophecy, and that's God and God alone. And so the critics, they'll try and dismiss the book. They'll say it's written by different Daniels, that it's a historical fiction or some form of forgery. But it is God who's writing this, and by inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is being penned by Daniel. If you're taking notes, there's an interesting passage in Isaiah chapter 41, verses 21 through 23, where the Lord says, "You really believe in prophecy, or you believe in these, rather, you believe in these gods? You want to go serve these gods? Well, then I challenge them to the duel, to a challenge of prophecy." Because he says, "I'm the only one who can deal in it." And you'll see what these people believe. If you want to follow this God, you'll end up believing in one that cannot deal in this realm, because he's not a God. It's a demon, basically, in essence. So we serve a God who deals in the realm of prophecy, and he's amazing. So it talks about three more kings that will arise in Persia, and then a fourth. This is Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, Darius, and then the fourth one would be Xerxes. And it says that he'll stir up all against the realm of Greece. And so Herodotus, he's a historian, he says that the army of Xerxes was over 5 million men. And there was another group of people, the Carthaginians, and they had an additional 300 men. So there was this a great amassing of an army that's being formed. Verses 3 and 4, as I said, it's going to be a lot of history, but the prophecy moves on to Alexander the Great. So follow along as I read. It says, "Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these." So this is now talking about Alexander the Great. If you're paying attention, each one of these kingdoms that we've been talking about, and again, we've already covered these things, if you're making the connections, it really tells us a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more about the Antichrist. And so Alexander the Great takes on a certain aspect of the Antichrist as well. And that is basically, he's going to do his will. And you see that in verse 3. He's going to have great dominion. He's going to have a rule. And that's the way that Alexander the Great was. But Alexander the Great is represented in Daniel 2 as the Bronze Kingdom. He's represented as the Leopard in Daniel chapter 7. And so these are the connections for us. But keep in mind, behind all of the earthly rule that we see, there's invisible fortress forces involved. And in Daniel chapter 10, verse 20, we see there was a prince of Persia. There's a prince of Greece. I share with you my view on this is I think that there are demonic forces over certain areas. It goes on to say, rather than read the rest of the verse, that he's going to rise up, and then he's going to die suddenly, and then there's going to be the four winds. And basically, if you remember this, there's four divisions to the kingdom that's going to take over for Alexander the Great. He had this incredible rise. In about 8 years' time, he conquered what was really to be known as the whole world. And then he dies suddenly. He thought he'd conquered the whole world, and he says there's no reason for living. He went out, he got drunk, he got pneumonia, and he came home and he died a short period after that. Well, he didn't have any children to pass it on to. And so there were four kingdoms, four army generals that took over for him. The northern kingdom was Seleucus. The southern kingdom was Ptolemy. The western kingdom was Cassander. The eastern kingdom was Lysimachus. And these guys ended up taking their different roles within the kingdom and leading and governing the way that they thought that they should. So now we get to verses 5 through 20. And we see that this is the conflict between the kings of the south and the kings of the north. The king of the south and the king of the north. And the king of the south was Ptolemy. If you remember, I was just sharing with you. The king of the north is Seleucus. From Daniel 11:5 through Daniel 11:35, about 150 years takes place. And the king of the south, let me read verses 5 and 6, and I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on here. And we'll talk about the history on all of this. Also, Daniel writing ahead in the future, we looking back and understanding what he's saying. Also, the king of the south, that was Ptolemy, shall be strong as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces. Excuse me. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority. Neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who bought her and with him who begot her and with him who strengthened her in those times. So basically, Ptolemy goes, the king of the south goes to the king of the north, and he says to Seleucus, hey, I've got a daughter, Bernice, and I want to give her to you, and I want you guys to get married. And then Seleucus says, well, you know, there's a problem. I'm married. And Ptolemy says, well, go ahead and divorce her. Just dump her and get rid of her. And so Seleucus does that. And so not a funny thing, but what happened was kind of funny. So he goes ahead and he gets rid of her. He marries Ptolemy's daughter. And then afterwards, Seleucus says, you know, I really want my wife back, my old wife back after Ptolemy dies. And so he takes his old wife back. And that very day, she stabs in the back, literally stabs in the back and kills him. And then Bernice goes on kill the baby, or his ex-wife goes on to kill Bernice and their baby that they'd had together. So what does it do? What does it do? Well, verses 7 through 9, it causes there to be some strife in the kingdom. And so we see Ptolemy's family getting a little upset here, verses 7 through 9. He says, but from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Also, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but he shall return to his own land. So they're upset. They're really mad. So they go up north and they take on the Syrians and they try and fight. And they end up taking back the 2,500 gods that they served, that they believed in. Verse 10, again, we're going to go quickly through the first 20 verses. The two sons from the north, we see them getting involved. It says, however, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. So the northern forces, they're upset. These two sons make a plan, and because of what you did, they said, you know what, this region, it's going to be our own. We're going to take it. So verses 13, 11 through 13, we see Antiochus the Fifth comes on the scene here, and it says, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, and the king of the north shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of the enemy, of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he be cast down. He will cast down tens of thousands, but will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come to the end of the years with a great army and much equipment. And so this Egyptian armies are filled with anger. They're going to go back and forth, and there's going to be battles there in Palestine. And then Antiochus the Fifth will come on the scene and wants to settle the issue once and for all. And we come to verses 14 through 18. There's an introduction to a very special princess here. Some of you guys might know who she is. It says, now in those times, Many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of the whole kingdom, of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus he shall do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or before him. After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. So, might be a little hard to see all of this, but the accuracy is pretty amazing. Antiochus seeks a union with Ptolemy IV, and he says, "Hey, I want my daughter to marry you." Antiochus deceptively sets his daughter as a spy in all of this. You might know this famous princess, this famous daughter of this man. Her name was Cleopatra, and Antiochus III, he didn't plan on this taking place, and so Ptolemy had a very handsome son. His name was Mark Antony, and Cleopatra was breathless with him, was enamored with him, and so she ended up following him, and this is where Antiochus was not, he didn't know all this was going to take place. And Antiochus goes for the coastlands, Greece, but then the Romans end up taking care of him and subduing him there. The last two verses of this section on history is the end of Antiochus. And it says here, verse 19, "Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle." So here in these verses, we kind of wrap up this section before we head on into Antiochus Epiphanes and the Antichrist section. And Antiochus goes home. He dies in the temple before his gods. And then his son Seleucus IV comes in and takes over. When he takes over, he realizes he's inherited this great kingdom, but the treasuries are empty. It's a bankrupt nation. So with the Romans imposing taxes on him, he imposes the taxes on the kingdom. Specifically, do you guys see, and we found him in the previous verses, but do you see there in verse 20, it says the glorious kingdom. This is a reference to Israel and to the temple in Jerusalem. So he doesn't just tax all of the people of his kingdom, but then he goes specifically after the temple and the funds that are coming in and taxes them and seizes them. So he's going after the kingdom of God, basically. Again, all of these things are kind of laying in and tied into the end, the Antichrist. So now we come to a character named Antiochus Epiphanes, and we're going to end up our study today about the Antichrist. These are arch enemies of God's people. In verses 21 through 35, it's going to talk about a foreshadowing. I want you guys to understand a foreshadowing. This is foreshadowing the Antichrist, and the one who will foreshadow the Antichrist will be Antiochus Epiphanes. We see his arrival in verse 21. It says, "And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue." Again, what I want you to do is to understand, we're now about ready. The relay runner is about ready to hit that mark. We're seeing all of these things. It's really setting us up for what's going to happen in the future. And he's a vile person. When we get to verse 31, we're going to see just how vile he was. This is not the Antichrist, but he was brutal. He didn't take the throne legitimately, but he came in with flattery, with smooth promises, with intrigue. The Antichrist has yet to come for us, but he's going to come at a certain point. And when he comes, he's going to come with very skillful, a very skillful tongue. I say all this because I think we need to be prepared for this. We need to be looking for this. Yeah.
Could intrigue also be construed as mesmerized? Mesmerizing the people?
I think so, yeah. So he's going to have this intrigue, this mystique about him. And where I think this will fit in, and we'll get into some of this now and a little bit in the book of Revelation, but he's going to come in with answers. We've got, I watch different things on YouTube. One of the things that I watch is some of these political things, and we've got an impeachment. From everything that I can see, the impeachment's based upon hearsay. They've listened. I don't know if you guys have followed this with the Ukrainian phone call and from the president to the president, but what is happening in our countries? We're not in a civil war, but we're in a civil diversity. We've got a group of people that are saying, "I only believe in this. I'm only going to be a Democrat." And we have people that say, "I'm only going to be a Republican," and there's no joining together. I heard a couple of moderate Democrats say this week that they're told, when you become a Democrat, you support the party, not the people. And they said, we've got a problem with that. We're civil servants. We're here for the people and not the party. And so we've got this thing where there's battle where the parties won't do bipartisan actions. They won't come together. And so really, the people who hurt the most is us, is the people. We got a lot of problems, and there's not a whole lot of answers on the table. Now listen, you and I happen to be in the one particular group who really truly has the answer, and that is Jesus Christ. If everybody would humble themselves, believe in Jesus, repent of their sins, dedicate their lives to him, everything would work out. There still would be problems, but there would be unity that would take place. But I say this, and I kind of introduce this, is because there's going to be this guy who's going to come on the scene later that Antiochus Epiphanes is foreshadowing, and he's the Antichrist, and he's going to come in, and he's going to come with mystique, intrigue. He's going to memorize because he's going to have this amazing ability to solve problems. And so he's going to have smooth promises, flattery. He's going to call himself, his name's Antiochus, he's one of the line of Antiochuses. But he's going to call himself Epiphanes. This means the illustrious one. But those Jews that were there, they called him Epimanes, which means the madman. He's a madman. Again, I rushed through the first 20 verses because we really have already covered this, and you should know this. You should be aware. Excuse me. Be aware of all this. But we live in a world, and we've, not currently, we live in a world that throughout history, we've seen madmen. We've seen men that have been filled with the spirit of Satan. A few of those would be Antiochus, which we're going to read more about in just a few minutes, Caesar Nero, Hitler. There's people who have come, and each one of these, not ironically, each one of these particular leaders hates the Jews. Hates God's people and wants to destroy them and does everything they possibly can to destroy them. So this is verse 21, his arrival. Verses 22 through 27, we're going to see his actions. Look at verse 22. It says this, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken. And also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus the Epiphanes, he's going to continue this battle between these dynasties of the north and the south, and his plans is to get his victims off guard. He wants to catch them when they're not paying attention. He wants to catch them when they're by offering them friendship and alliance. And then he does this thing. Do you guys see it at the end of verse 22? It says the prince of the covenant. This is the high priest Onias the Third. And what he did was at a certain point, he went in and he murdered the high priest, Onias the Third. He is known as the Prince of the Covenant. And so these are the things. Antiochus Epiphanes, this is what he does. He goes in and he causes turmoil and heartache, and he's vicious and he's vile. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So Antiochus's attempt will be to take over Egypt, but it's going to turn out worse for him. The Roman Empire will end up taking the place, and Antiochus will lose his power. Verses 26 and 27. Yet, yes, those who eat at the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Verse 27. But these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. So there's a certain point in time where Antiochus the Fourth, he is defeated there in Egypt by the Roman navy, and a Roman general draws a circle around him and he says, I demand you to surrender and give your allegiance to Rome. And from that point on, Antiochus is bound under Roman rule. Look at verses 28 through 35. We'll see his atrocities here. 28 says this, while he was returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. So Antiochus, being upset with the loss down in Egypt, on his way back home, he comes across the city of Jerusalem and he says, you know what? I'm going to take it as my own. Verses 29 and 30 says, at the appointed time, he shall return and go down toward the south, but he shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. So verses 29 through 30, it talks about Antiochus causing the Israelites to be divided. Some forsake their covenant with God, and they embrace the Greek culture and what he has. And so then he rewards them. There's going to be an apostate high priest named Menelaus, and he was the chief conspirator aiding Antiochus. So this is just the background on all this. Verse 31 says, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and the place there, the abomination of desolation. If you're paying attention, if you're catching this at all, again, this is the foreshadowing. This is Antiochus Epiphanes, but it's going to be pointing towards the Antichrist. If you're looking at all this, you're going to see this. Antiochus at a certain point, Antiochus Epiphanes will take a pig and he'll slaughter a pig on the altar. If you don't know this, pigs were not kosher, and you weren't to have anything to do with pigs. You weren't to eat them, you weren't to touch them, you weren't to slaughter them, you weren't to farm them or grow them or anything. So he takes that and he takes the blood and he smears it on the temple. He sets an image of Zeus or Jupiter or himself in the temple, and he says, I want you to worship this. Different historians will say different images, but it's going to be Zeus, Jupiter, or himself. And he says, I demand worship. This is the abomination of desolation. When we finish up the book of Daniel, we get into Matthew 24, there's going to be a certain point where Jesus is going to talk about the abomination of desolation. This goes back to Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, which talks about the abomination of desolation, which is when the Antichrist sits on the throne in Israel, in Jerusalem, and says, I'm God, worship me. We're going to get to the book of Revelation. I want you to understand these are like, it's dropped in there. Daniel 9, Daniel 11, Matthew 24, Revelation 13, where there's going to be an image set up in the temple, and the Antichrist is going to say, worship me. But we're not talking about the Antichrist. We're talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. It's a foreshadow of what's yet to come. When you go outside and the sun is behind you, it kind of looks like you, but it's not you. Right? This is kind of like the Antichrist, but it's not him yet. Verse 32, we see there's a response. It says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And so there's going to be a group of people that are going to go right along with him. They're going to be succumb to the flattery and persuasion of getting the rewards that Antiochus Epiphanes has to offer. But then there's going to be a remnant that will remain faithful to God. And they're going to do great things. They're going to know God. They're going to personalize God. They're going to strengthen themselves from God. And they're going to accomplish things for God. We want to make sure that we're on that particular group of people. In this day and age, we want to make sure that we're making those decisions to live for the Lord and be really, truly gutsy people. Verses 33 through 35 says, "And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and by plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them and purify them and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time." So if you want to look at a good history book, 1 Maccabees chapter 2 verses 31 through 38 talks about this, about Antiochus and knowing the Jews wouldn't fight on the Sabbath. And so he ends up coming into Israel and he just lays an onslaught against these people who were not prepared. He took advantage of something that he knew about their faith. Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, his attack on Jerusalem, history has proven it killed 80,000 Jews. He took 40,000 more as prisoners. He sold another 40,000 as slaves, and he pillaged the temple, robbing of around what we would understand to be about $1 billion. This guy is just not someone to be messed with. And that was a guy that was in the past. He has no regard for God's people. I don't want to scare anybody. I don't think I'm going to scare anybody. But I've said for years, I don't think it's going to get a whole lot better for us. I think things are going to get more difficult. And I think that as the forces of the Antichrist or Satan arise in this world, I think things are going to just get more intense. I think there's going to be a certain point that the Antichrist will come on the scene. And if we're still around, then it's going to be horrendous for us. So we need to be prepared for that. So the question arises back then, and the question arises in yet our future, why would God allow these horrible things to come against his people? And in verse 35, it says, and it gives us that answer, it says that he wants to refine them and purify them. One thing we need to remember is when we go through the tough times, that there is a meaning and a purpose for them. If you're going through a tough time, you need to have that faith that you trust the Lord. That he, even though he's bringing you to a place that seems horrible and doesn't seem fair even, he's refining you and he's purifying you. And there's some sort of growth that takes place in all of that that cannot be bought, that cannot be changed, that cannot be given away. It's something that you earn by making it through those tough times. The last part of the verse talks about the last days that the Antichrist will come. And Antiochus Epiphanes is categorized with the Antichrist as a group of people that is, I wouldn't want to be in that group. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to be in that group. So now we take this dramatic jump from verse 35 to 36, and the rest of the chapter is going to talk about the Antichrist. Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, he lived during the period of the first weeks of the 69 weeks of Daniel's 70 weeks, and now the Antichrist will come during the 70th week. And so the foreshadowing now becomes the real thing in verses 36 through 45, and this is the future. Verse 36 through 39 talks about a glimpse of his wickedness. It says, "Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the god of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strong fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. He shall cause them to rule over many, and divide the land for gain. So these scriptures that we're going through right now, they're talking about this last Gentile ruler. This is the Antichrist. This is where the real abomination of desolation will take place. We see in verse 36, we see that there's a condemnation that takes place here. And it's really where the very heart of the Antichrist is at. Antiochus Epiphanes prepared us for it, but now we're seeing the Bible tell us about this future leader and how incredibly evil he will be. It says that he shall do according to his own will. Again, we talked about this. The Antichrist is going to do his will over God's will. The number one rule in the Satanic Bible is do what thou wilt. That's the way it's written. Do what you want to do. We've seen it morph into our media. Do what you want to do. And then it's taken on a new slant in the media. Do what you want to do, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. Well, it's going to hurt you, and it's going to hurt people around you if you're not doing the will of God. And we see our nation has taken a nosedive because we've allowed this sort of mindset and philosophy, ideology to take place. We see it contrasted with Jesus, where Jesus says, I always do the will of my Father. The next thing he says here in describing the Antichrist, he says, he shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. This is very close to the way Lucifer was described in Isaiah chapter 14, verses 13 and 14, where he says, I'm going to have my throne above the heavens. It's going to be like God's. It's also mentioned in 2 Thessalonians 2:4, Revelation 13:6. But basically it is, I'm going to magnify myself. I'm going to put myself above every other god. This is going to be the heart of the Antichrist. We see a contrast with Jesus where he says in Philippians 2, I'm going to humble myself. I'm going to take on the form of a bondservant. I'm going to live a perfect life, and then I'm going to die, and I'm going to receive all of the sins of the world at one time, and I'm going to pay with my life, and all of the sins are going to be thrust upon me that those who believe in me can get saved and become the righteousness of God. So we see Jesus emptying himself rather than filling himself and making him better. And it goes on, it says, he shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods. You know, we're not far from that. There used to be a time where there were sacred things. You don't talk about God. When I was growing up, like, there were certain things. You didn't steal from churches. You know what happens around here? When I couldn't believe it when I moved out to the Bible Belt in Texas. And then all of a sudden, these air conditioning units, I would hear on the news, another church is vandalized. These thieves come in and they take away the copper. I don't know how much copper is in. I know some people know more than I do, but it must be at least a little bit. It must be a little bit substantial, to not just a couple pieces. But they come in and they steal these copper pipes. And I think, what is wrong with this world? Of all places, like, you don't steal from God. But when you take God away and take God away and take God away and you let these kids grow up thinking whatever they want to think, well, why wouldn't you steal? It's not God. There's no such thing as God. This is just a building where a group of people that are need to lean on a crutch, and they're not very confident. They need something in their life because they're messed up and broken. That's the way the world views us. But you know what's funny is when they get broken, they come to us and ask for prayer, right? But then that's when we're to be praying for them. We're not to have any maliciousness in our heart. So this is what the Antichrist will do, is he will speak blasphemies and nobody's going to put up a fight. If you speak against certain groups of people, up in Canada right now, which recently they've been leading the charge on a lot of things. If you speak against homosexualities, you could be thrown in jail as a pastor. Hate speech, because I'm teaching the Bible. I'll say in just a minute, but homosexuality is wrong. And I'll keep saying it. And if people, you know, if I get thrown in jail, pray for me, you know. But what do we do there? We preach in prison and we see hundreds of people get saved, right? When they're wrongfully imprisoned. So I'm just saying, like, these things are, it's not that far. So yesterday, I'm gonna go off on a tangent. I try not to do this very often, but I think it's timely. You guys have been good so far, listening to a lot of history, and take a deep breath. So I'm watching YouTube, one of the videos that came on. Before the video came, like, you know how they have, like, commercial ads? Well, there's a new credit card that, you know, so my credit card in my wallet, it's down there. It's got a little chip on it, so you slide it in, right? Okay, well, that I could see connection, right? The wrist, right? The right wrist, the forehead. I could see some of the technology going that way. But this new card, it's like a smart metric card or whatever. You put your thumb on it, and it you do it four times, and it gives you like identification on that card. So then nobody can use it. Because here's the thing. We have all this theft, all this technology where people can go in. If you don't have the right wallet, people can walk up behind. And I don't know how this works exactly. They can come up beside you, and they can swipe something and pull data and then charge things on your credit card. So you want to have like a metal piece. I mean, there's all, I don't even know how this stuff works. To the pure, all things are pure. I don't want thinking of stealing from people, you know? So now we're being set up because of all this new technology, and our world can't control it. To the point that you stick your card in, no longer sliding. I mean, you can still slide it sometimes, but now you don't slide it. You stick it in. It reads that chip. I remember years ago that strip that you used to slide, that magnetic strip, that kind of brownish black strip. When I was back in the 90s, I heard that it contained 750 pages of information. I'm sure it's even more than that now. This chip probably can hold even more than that. So how do you protect yourself? Well, now you just put your fingerprint. Now it's starting to get more personalized, you see? And then the next thing they'll say is, well, then you can swipe your wrist. We're going to put it in you, so hey, don't leave home without it, you know? You'll have it. So I'm saying this because when we look at the Antichrist, we've finished now. The relay runner has come. We've turned. We've got the baton. We're now running forward. And what are we seeing? The future. This is the Antichrist. And he's going to speak great blasphemies against the God of gods. You can't say things as Christians in this world, but you can certainly slander God, and you'll be rewarded in this world. We're seeing those things now come to pass. The Antichrist is a very smooth operator, and he's very talented at public speaking. He will blow Adolf Hitler away. Do you know what one of Adolf Hitler's number one principles was to public speaking? If you tell a lie, tell it often enough, because at a certain point people will believe it. And we live in a world where we see that. It's sound bites. People say things, like Trump. Well, you know, he colluded with the Ukraine. He, you know, they say it enough, and it gets on the media enough. Well, of course, that's what he does. And then they're going to do an investigation. And I'm not trying to go political. This is just fresh this week. And then they're going to do an investigation. And this phone call, it's going to be go through the transcripts, and it's going to be proven to be nothing. I got to go a little bit, move forward here, but this Antichrist is going to be incredibly persuasive. And if you've heard people who can argue, if you've heard Ravi Zacharias, imagine a Ravi Zacharias for the devil and being persuasive and being able to argue and having the fullness of thousands and thousands of years, who knows how long the devil's been around, and the devil's going to be feeding into him, and then he's going to be speaking for the devil. So even more of a reason to be ready for persuasive tongues. It says, the verse goes on, believe it or not, I'll go to the next part of the verse. It says, he shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what he has been for what has been determined shall be done. And so the prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. There's going to be the end of the 7-year period. This is the end of the tribulation period that we're talking about. Verses 37 through 39, we go from the condemnation with this Antichrist to the character. Look at verse 37, the beginning of it. This is his heritage. It says, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers, right? I'm going to stop right there because the next part's a different point. So he's not going to value his heritage. He, from these verses, he's going to be a Jew. And he's not going to regard the God of his fathers. He's going to reject the God of his fathers, because the God of his fathers is Jehovah. It's Jesus Christ. So I believe that he's going to be a Jew. The next thing we see is the value of the Messiah. Stay with me on this. There's a couple of different interpretations. Nor will he value or regard the desire of women. Can be taken two ways. One, in that day, in that culture, when Daniel's writing, every Jewish woman wanted to be the mother of the Messiah. They knew the Messiah would come at a certain point, and so that was the place of honor. If I can just be the mother of the Messiah, that was their desire. So the desire of women was to be, this is one interpretation, would be to be the mother of the Messiah. In other words, the Antichrist says, I don't want the Messiah at all. I don't desire the Messiah coming into this world. I hate the Messiah. That's one view. The other view is not having the desire of women. And this is how traditionally I've taught it. He's going to be a homosexual. I don't know. Could be. I can tell you this. It sure does seem to be picking up a whole lot of steam in this world to be a homosexual. Certainly not. You're not faulted for it anymore. There used to be a time where you could go to prison in this country. All right, verses 38 and 39. These verses talk about his religion. It says, but in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses. So he's going to be much more caught up with the military conquest. This is what verse 38 is saying. And then verse 39 is going to talk about the elements that the Antichrist craves so much, and he's going to be giving it to his followers. We see verses 40 through 43 talking about a glimpse of his warfare. Verse 40 says this. This is the place that the warfare will take place. It says that at that time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. And so somewhere, this will take place someplace in the nation of Israel. If you want to tie in another passage, Ezekiel 38 and 39 states specifically that this is going to be an army coming from the north, and this is they're going to be coming into Israel to do battle. If you want to know the end times, it's been said that the Israel is, you know, the world is a clock, Israel is the minute or the hour hand, and Jerusalem is the minute hand. So if you want to know what's happening in end times, look at Jerusalem, look at Israel, and that will tell you what's happening in the world. This is what's going to happen with the Antichrist. He's going to do war there in Israel. Verses 41 through 43, we see the people. We go from the place to the people. He says, he shall also enter the glorious land. We're talking about Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. So here's the people that are going to be involved. Israel, Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. He's going to be going out and conquering them. He's going to be doing battle with them. Verses 40 and 45, the last couple of verses here that talk about the glimpse of his wrath. Verse 44, here's the news. It says, but the news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. Now we're coming into that period known as the Battle of Armageddon. There's going to be a period of time. People thought this couldn't happen for the longest time. This is why the book of Daniel cannot be true. Book of Revelation talks about an army coming in to this Battle of Armageddon being 200 million soldiers. And before 1960s, nobody thought it could even happen. And then on a radio in the early 1960s, and radio Peking shared that in 1 month's time they could accumulate, they could muster up a 200 million soldier army. And so this is the Battle of Armageddon. Remember, we know that other prophecies in the Old Testament talk about this Battle of Armageddon, that the blood is going to be so thick, it's going to be so drenched. You can imagine with 200 million soldiers that it'll come up to the horse's bridle. I used to think, oh, it's going to be like a lake of blood. It's not going to be a lake of blood. The blood is going to be so thick in the mud. It's going to be such a bloody mud. A horse will always remain and keep his head above the water. We'll be able to breathe. And if there's mud going up, it'll keep its head above that. So this area of Armageddon is going to be a bloodbath as these nations come in, and he's going to do war with them. I'll take a little tangent, but at a certain point, the Lord's going to come down, and he's going to turn it, and everybody's going to all start firing off at the Lord Jesus, and they're going to all get destroyed. A little added to this. But then we come to verse 45, and we see the end. Verse 45 says, and he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. And this is what's going to happen in that Valley of Megiddo, that Battle of Armageddon, is that there's going to be this bloodbath. There's going to be absolute warfare that's going to come together, and he's going to come to his end, and nobody will come to rescue him. He'll have no loyal followers at that point. He'll be dead. And so what we need to do is we need to be prepared. There was a wealthy man who was in California, and he went into a very expensive gift shop, one that had very special items, and he went in and he saw this beautiful barometer. It's like a clock-like instrument that measures the weather. And he looked at it and he said, "This is amazing. I've never seen one like this. This is astounding. I've got to have it. How much is it?" And they said $500. So he bought it. He lived in Long Island. He was out in California. He had it packaged up. He had it sent back to Long Island. When he got back, he unpackaged it and he was reading the instructions. He looked at it and he said, "This thing's broken." He was reading that there's going to be a tornado on the way. He said, "This thing's broken." So he began writing a letter. He went to work, wrote a letter to the company that distributed it and the people who sold it to him. He said, "This is broken." And when he got back home, his house had been completely blown away by a small tornado that went through. For us, the application is pretty clear, is that we need to be aware. We know that the barometer spiritually is saying that there's going to be the Antichrist. Things are building up to the Antichrist. We need to be ready for the Antichrist so that when he comes, we don't have, nor do we allow a tornado to sweep through, a spiritual tornado to sweep through and to destroy us as it did that man in his house. Let's pray.